ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In an ordinary Sydney suburb, a family lives unnoticed.
You came across so innocent.
Father and son keep mostly to themselves.
We didn't go beyond the friendly nod or hello.
But behind closed doors...
Something's gone wrong. Big time.
If you don't make phone calls, nobody can tap you.
A new three-part series investigates how the road to Bondi began long before the first shots rang out. The Road to Bondi. Search Background Briefing wherever you get your podcasts.
Jez, have you ever been on a Harley?
Not a Harley, but I did do a massive road trip once with some friends and I sat in the sidecar. From Kalgoorlie through Widgiemortha to Norseman in remote WA, and it was one of the most memorable road trips of my
life. What's it like being in a sidecar for that distance?
You've got zero control. It's bumpy as all get out. And I was caked in squashed bugs. But it was really, I mean, literally the wind in your hair feeling.
Yeah, a lot of
wind.
And
surrendering.
Right.
That control and power to someone else in this vehicle was really quite incredible.
Wow. See, I'd ridden motorbikes before, but I'd never actually sat on a Harley.
Right.
And I tell you, it's really great. It's
That's why there are
different...
films and songs about it, right?
Yes.
So how would you describe it?
Like powerful, like there's the sound of the exhaust. There's the speed, there's the smoothness. And it was also, I wasn't riding in a pack, there was like four of us. But that sense of we're a group and you go through any kind of other group of people and everyone turns because the Harley Davidsons are going through town. It's kind of fascinating, actually.
And I can hear our listeners asking, how did Julia Baird come to be riding down a road in a pack of Harleys?
And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Hey, Jez and Jules here with a bonus episode of Not Stupid. And Jules, we've got to talk about this piece that you've been working on for months now.
Yes.
And I'm so excited to see it finally published. Tell us about it.
Okay, so it's about a group called Bikers Against Child Abuse, BACCA. And I came across a mention of them once online in America. And I was like, that's a really interesting group, Bikers Against Child Abuse. Like, what would that look like? How would that
work? It's not a Venn diagram you imagine would naturally overlap.
No, no. And so I tried to find if there were any in Australia and any local to me, and I tracked some down and I tried to convince them to talk to me, and it took quite some time.
What was that like, that process of, I mean, bikers and people who have been exposed to child abuse are famously closed and have issues, legitimate issues around trust and outsiders coming in. What was that like for you as a journalist going in there and say, hey?
Yeah, so it was, if we leave aside the kids that have been through it at first, because the bikers wouldn't even let me get to them to talk to them. Like, that took a very long time till I finally could speak to some mothers, and then I spoke to a kid. So, the bikers, you're right, like are very suspicious of any media attention, very conscious of stereotyping, of like easy ways that they could be dismissed or seen. Like, you must never, ever confuse a biker with a bikie, with the 1%.
Right.
Now, when I first met Preacher, who's the head of the New South Wales chapter, because they all go by their road names to protect their identities and ward off the perpetrators from the kids that they're helping, in a club out in Sydney's west, they have signs up around those clubs saying the 1% not welcome here. And the 1% being the outlaws, the criminal groups, and the 99% of bikers who are the rest who are, you know, law abiding. Now, that's not a strict statistic. It's used kind of as a metaphor that that's a very small minority.
And can I, like, look, I don't like to comment about people's appearances generally, but they do look a bit scary. They do. And one of them is a former gravedigger who goes by the name Reaper.
Reaper.
I'd be a bit terrified.
Yeah, but that's kind of the point. You know, like, that they have physical presence and they are not afraid of you, and they will stand between, they will surround a kid and who has been abused at the most vulnerable time in their life where they're wrestling with trauma and try to make them feel safe. Now, they're not vigilantes. They're not like, we're going to go out there and fight people on your behalf. Although they do say, and I'm going to come back to Reaper in a second, because he really did make me think hard about why people were getting involved in this. But they don't have any contact with perpetrators. Their mission statement says, we stand at the ready to shield these children from further abuse. We do not condone the use of violence or physical force in any manner. However, if circumstances arise such that we are the only obstacle preventing a child from further abuse, we stand ready to be that obstacle. Fundamentally, they want to be that threat. So that presence and being scary, and they've got, you know, beards running down their chests.
And leather jackets and tattoos.
All of it. Yep. And all the patches, which are, you know, show they're patched up members of BACA. What they do is they will take the kids to court, sometimes repeatedly, because sometimes the kids will be too scared to go into court. They will be available to them 24/7. So if they're afraid, they can't get to sleep, they will come and stand outside your place. There might have been a perpetrator driving past and intimidating you or the perpetrator's family. In one case, they camped on a front lawn for 18 days. I think, just trying to make sure that a kid felt safe. So what happens is, like, someone will contact, might have heard of this group and might get in contact, and then they will say, okay, well, it needs to have been reported to the police. It needs to have an event or a case number. This needs to already be in the system. They're not just going to go by, someone says, oh, that guy did X, Y, and Z. You know, they have to be alongside, you know, a justice system that's already in place. They will then usually meet with the parent, and then eventually they will come and meet with the kid, who can be a bit wary, a bit uncertain, and they have a couple of things they do. They give them a little biker jacket for themselves, and they give them a teddy bear, and they got this ritual that the kids said they found really moving, which was everyone. So sometimes three chapters will come, like, so there'll be a bunch of bikers there, and they'll all pass around the teddy bear and each hug it.
Oh,
before
wow.
giving it to the child.
This is, I mean, this blows my mind, because
yes.
it's just not the thing you would expect from a biker group.
There was so much genuine, like a really fierce determination to look after these kids. But wait, so then they give it to the child, and some of the kids will then like carry that bear with them everywhere.
That's been infused with care and love.
Because they're right? now part of the family. We're
yeah.
here for you.
Yeah.
Like, and they have this real thing, bikers, we keep our bond, our word is our bond, like out the corporate world, says one of them.
That stood out to me in this.
Yes.
They say, you know, the number one rule is to always keep your promise to a child.
That's it. You turn up.
Which, I mean, that gave me shivers when I read that, because I thought, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Always keeping your promise to a child.
Yeah. And the third thing they do is they take the kid on a ride.
Right. Okay.
So they can choose which bike they want to go on. And they all said, now I interviewed three chapters in West Leagues Club at Campbelltown one Sunday. And the point at which they all started to talk over each other was when I said, what was it like when they came back? And they were like, oh, they get this spark in their eye. I can't describe it. You've got to be there. You've got to see it. Something happens to the kid. They've been in this kind of surrounded by this, literally almost the noise of it, I think, as well. Oh. And these bikers, and you're now part of this group, and they take you out and it's fun. You get the adrenaline. Like when I went out, I got like so much adrenaline. I was high as a kite. And I was interested that they all said that and they all landed on it. And then when I spoke to a kid that had been through the system, she said to me, and she said she'd been suicidal and self-harming, and that when she got off the back of the bike after her first ride, that she felt that she had a spark that had been returned, and she suddenly thought, okay, everything's going to change and I'm safe now. There were people in her corner. Obviously, you're not automatically safe. I don't want to kind of like broadcast that. But so she felt that something had really shifted for her.
And it's interesting too what that means for a child who's been exposed to sexual abuse, because, you know, we've both interviewed people who've endured that. And one of the kind of fundamental issues that people who experience sexual abuse and who've survived it speak about, the sense of abandonment.
Yes.
And so this is what they're trying to address, right? To kind of rebuild that wall, that scaffolding around a child to help them kind of feel secure again.
And one of the mothers was telling me, oh, and the kid who'd been through it as well gave evidence, but outside the, you know, in another room that was beamed into the court, but had to be in court to deliver her victim impact statement. And on that day, her mother was there. Some else of her family were there, and there was like more than a dozen, there was like backer people just sitting there. We're just here.
Why do these people, it's men and women, right? The bikers. Yep. Yep. Why do they volunteer?
See, that was the one thing I wanted to find out. To me, like, why do you put your hand up for this kind of work? And a lot of it is barbecues, meetings. There's a lot of rules you've got to abide by. There's a lot of rules. They're very strict on it in this organisation. And a lot of it is because they've got to be so careful about protecting the kids. And that's what I actually congregated everyone to kind of ask them about. And I tell you what I was really blown away by. Firstly, how earnest and genuine everyone was in trying to like tell me. Secondly, the number of people that cried when I was speaking to them. So you mentioned Reaper. Reaper was a grave digger. And he said to me, oh, my reason's a bit darker than other people here. Look, I just had dug a lot of graves and I was sick of digging graves for kids and teenagers. And I would look around at the families and I'd go, what has gone wrong here? And why weren't they protected? And someone wasn't there for that kid. And if only they'd felt like there was another option. And so he went off and he found this group and he got patched in the time that I was reporting it, which is a big moment when you get your actual patch and you become an official member. Because you can't ask to be a member. You will be asked if you've done all the prerequisite training and all that kind of thing. Other people wanted a sense of purpose. They had a wife that died and they were struggling with their mental health. There was someone who had been discharged from the army for medical reasons and, again, wanted a sense of serving and helping people. Preacher who'd worked with kids, youth groups in church groups. Again, how do I combine my love of bikes with my desire to kind of look after kids? But there were also a bunch who themselves felt like they knew what some of the kids were going through. There was Gidget who had been through terrible domestic violence and her son was there as well and kind of struggled to speak about it and said, I know what they've been through. I know the trauma of the court process, and kind of described to me in great detail how she angled her body so that she would be able to protect the kid from any glares or stares of the perpetrator or friends of the perpetrator, and walking him in and out as well, making sure the kid was in the middle of them and was as protected in that way. And then there were others who'd been abused themselves as kids.
You mentioned that they try very hard and do the necessary administration to work alongside the justice system.
Yeah.
How does the justice system recognise them in that whole kind of court process, which is really confronting for most people,
yeah,
particularly children?
Yeah, that's right. And then suddenly some kids are turning up with a big biker, two big bikers. Yeah, the primaries have to, they get two primaries and they have to have two bikers with them at all times. It's not a one-on-one thing, which again is a protective measure. One of their great frustrations is that the official, like the government agencies, say we have enough systems in place now. We have systems here for victims, people who are testifying in court, people who are going through trauma, counselling systems, and, you know, it just kind of indicating that there isn't necessarily a need for it. But I tell you, they still obviously can go through court, and if that's the will of the child to have them with them. And so one kid I spoke to, and the mum was saying that like a month before the court case was on, this primary drove to the court, worked out where the access point was, when they could drop off the kid, if they were going to be able to walk around that kid, what they could wear, because sometimes they're not allowed to wear those vests up into court, and then arrived on the day with a bag with books and like snacks and like all the rest of it. So a lot of care goes into the court process.
And they're a registered charity, right? So they're kind of
not for profit. Yeah. That's right.
You've had a massive response to this, and I can see why. What have people been writing in and telling you?
Let me try to pull some of them up, actually. One person did say, thanks to this story, I was moved by the good work the backer is doing. Mind you, it's a lot of trouble to go just to get a ride on a Harley. But really, like another, like this piece brought me to tears with respect and thanks to backer members for their commitment to kids living in fear. Wonderful humans. It was more the sense of, oh, I'm so amazed this is actually happening in this world, and in a news cycle where we're just bombarded with the very worst of us, that there are a lot of people out there in communities not saying we're heroes, we want a public profile, we want these accolades, but doing what they can with the time they have and whoever they are. They call themselves a bunch of recalcitrants. They say we're flawed human beings. And just doing what they can to make other people feel safe. And I really think it's important, Jez, that we tell the story about those volunteers around this country who spend countless hours trying to turn up and lift up and just be there for people, because there are many, many people across those nations. If we forget about them, then like the world looks very bleak. But they're everywhere.
Angels in disguise. They're all around us. Jules, nice to catch up. And if this has raised any issues for you, there's always help available from Beyond Blue and through Lifeline as well.
And we'll also put a link to the article on our show notes. See you, Jez.